Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 287 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris. We have a tremendous discussion coming up for you here today. This is going to be truly, truly outstanding. Ironically, our most recent discussion on this show, where nothing is off topic, also involved a major figure in sports media, number 286, a conversation with Rick Bucher, NBA insider for NBC Sports and Comcast. Very much the same lines today. Somebody who covers actually the NBA, NCAA basketball, and the NFL. And so we're going to be talking about all of these with him today. Of course, this is Ian Eagle of the YES Network, and more prominently on a national scale, CBS Sports. Going to be very, very happy to talk to him. But again, a tremendous pleasure for I, Rick Morris, to get to bring in our guest today. This is going to be a wonderful discussion, I am sure. He is entering his 20th year of covering what had been the New Jersey Nets, now in their second year of being the Brooklyn Nets. He covers them as play-by-play announcer for the YES Network, entering his 16th year covering the AFC as a play-by-play announcer for CBS. And I have to say, on a side note, I am extraordinarily jealous of this gentleman, not because it's a great job, which I'm sure it is, and it would be a tremendous job for any of us to get to do on a daily basis, but on a more substantive level in life. This is somebody who, having broadcast so many games for my crappy Cleveland Browns over the years, he will not have to spend a day in purgatory, ladies and gentlemen. He has already served out his time here on Earth. And so, again, unfortunately for him, he may have some more Browns games in his future this year, and I can only send along my sympathy to him as much as I will enjoy hearing his call of these games. But I speak, of course, of the great Ian Eagle of CBS Sports and the YES Network. Ian, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. Pleasure to have you on.
Rick, I have a special guest with me. It's Spurgeon Wynn. He wants to chat with me.
I don't think Spurgeon Wynn could possibly deny what I had to say about that. You've got what seems to be a disproportionate number of Browns games over the years, and unfortunately this fall will probably carry a few more for you as well. But you have gotten through them in very good humor and with a strong sense of professionalism, sir.
It's a great football town. It's a great stadium to work in. I actually enjoy going there. And, you know, obviously because of the history of the franchise, you hope they can turn it around. It looks like Chudzinski has the right attitude. They're certainly making changes, sweeping changes to the team. And, again, on a personal level, I enjoy going into that city and doing games. You just hope that maybe they can squeeze out some more wins over time.
That's a great heritage. I just wish selfishly more of it was of recent vintage rather than childhood spent in the dog pound being the last thing we had to look forward to here. But, yeah, it's quite an interesting landscape on the AFC this year. It has looked maybe for the last year or two like the pendulum might be swinging a little bit to the NFC in terms of some of the top heavier teams. Then again, the defending Super Bowl champion comes out of the AFC this past year. So what are your thoughts on the American Conference relative to some of the top teams over in the NFC?
Yeah, I think you're right, Rick. I think there has been a bit of a shift, and the NFC has gotten stronger. The AFC still has some pizzazz because of New England, the defending champions, the Baltimore Ravens. Certainly Denver now is a factor. Indianapolis is a factor. Houston is a team that you have to keep an eye on. The fact of the matter is there's an unpredictable nature to the NFL. Every time you think you have a handle on things, it can change, and it can change very quickly. It's the one league, and it's been proven that a team that's finished in last place finds a way at the top of the division the very next year. Teams that you didn't envision as a potential playoff team, they improve very quickly in this league. It's based on schedule And obviously, you get impact players, that changes the whole situation. So I think maybe for a guy like you who has been so focused on the AFC North, expectations do change a bit. And the Pittsburgh Steelers, that's a perfect example of a team that's in transition now. And I'm not sure what to expect. I don't know that the Pittsburgh Steelers, player for player, can go into the season feeling the way that they have felt in previous years, where they were just going to be able to play smash-mouth football, follow the lead of Mike Tomlin, and get wins consistently. This is now a team and a franchise that's going to have to work for it. A lot of teams have closed the gap in the AFC, and I don't know if Pittsburgh has improved enough to say with any real confidence that they're at the level that they once were. That's a prime example of how things can change in the NFL.
Well, you're absolutely right, Ian, that it is a fool's errand to try to look too far down the road. Having said that, let me go there for a second here and run this by you. Our most recent guest on the program, Rick Bucher, did agree with me on this supposition, albeit, again, he's based out of the Bay Area, so perhaps a bit biased in agreeing with me on this. My sense is 49ers-Seahawks rivalry of the 2010s, at the very least, to me, the leader in the clubhouse. So what are your senses on how that may shape up in the years to come?
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. I think San Francisco is just built for the long term. Young quarterback, electrifying player, all the pieces covered on offense. Defensively, probably the best team in football right now. Dynamic players on that side of the ball. And a coach that gets the most out of them. That's what Harbaugh has brought to the table. Whatever questions there were regarding his passion level, regarding how that would translate on the professional level, he answered, and he answered very quickly. The one thing about NFL players that I think is sometimes a misnomer, these guys want to be coached, because if you're being coached the right way and you produce, that means individually you benefit. If the team plays well, you get certainly more publicity. If you get more publicity and the team is winning, contract time, you have more leverage, whether it's with your team or another team. So this idea that, oh, it's the NFL, they don't want to be coached. Yes, they do. If you can help them win, if you can help them put up better numbers, they're on board. You just have to prove it, and Harbaugh has done that. So, yes, San Francisco is certainly in that class. Pete Carroll, very similar mindset of the rah-rah style, the kind of guy that can walk that fine line between being authoritative and being friendly and being close with his guys. He brought that collegiate atmosphere, and it's worked. If you go into Seattle, and I've had the good fortune of calling a few of their games over the last couple of years, a fantastic city, really beautiful stadium, one of the top five stadiums in the NFL, a great backdrop with the downtown area just behind it. He has created an atmosphere and a culture that he was brought on to create. This is a guy that said he would change things, and he's done that. He's looked for a certain kind of player. He's delivered on that personnel-wise. And then coaching, clearly he has been able to get through to these guys. So I think there are a lot of similarities on how those two teams built their squads and to get quarterbacks that a bunch of other teams could have had that have that little extra something, that's something that you just can't necessarily look on film and say automatically, oh, yeah, this guy's going to be a star in the NFL. There's something that goes along with heart, how you handle yourself, how guys respond to you, and Kaepernick and Wilson have that, and they have it in excess right now.
Great point. Neither of them first-round quarterbacks, albeit Kaepernick didn't miss by much, but as far as it goes, with those two and with Andrew Luck, the emergence of those three in the last year, probably one of the bigger stories in the league in the last year or so. How much have you gotten to see of these guys? What are your impressions, whether it be in person or whether it be the amounts of game tape that you watch getting ready for the broadcast every week?
Which team are we talking about? I'm sorry.
Well, any of the three. What impressions have they made on you as far as relative strengths or weaknesses at this point in their careers?
Well, of those two quarterbacks, I have sat down with Russell Wilson. I had the New England-Seattle game last year, and blown away. I had heard great things about him. You know, you walk into these meetings, and I've done enough of these now through the years, you can get a good feel for what kind of leadership skills these guys have, especially at the quarterback position, Rick. You know, I think back, the first game I did at CBS was Indianapolis, Miami, 1998, season opener, Peyton Manning's first game in the NFL. And when I tell you, we're fortunate at the network level to meet with the head coach and five players before every game. Peyton Manning, day one, I was blown away. I was impressed by the way he carried himself, the way he looked you in the eye, the way he answered your questions, the way he said your name in answering those questions, taking the time to do that, the attention to detail. You just knew that this guy was going to be able to lead at that position. 3 weeks later, I meet with Ryan Leaf. I do a San Diego Chargers game. And it really was a 180-degree difference between the two. Couldn't really look you in the eye. Was short and curt with his answers. And you say, well, what's the big deal? If the guy can sling the football, then that's all that matters. No, I think you realize, especially in this day and age when you're investing that much money in these quarterbacks and other skill position players, that you need to see that other side of them. And I saw that with Wilson. No doubt about it, this guy is the goods. And I think the team responded to that and were able to feed off of his abilities, not only on the field but off the field. The fact that he's a class act, and he backs it up. As far as Kaepernick, I've seen the physical abilities. I've not had a chance to sit down with him. Andrew Luck with the Indianapolis Colts, it's all football. He's all business. He actually has a pretty good sense of humor, but it's pretty simple stuff with him. You know, the guy's got a flip phone. That's all you need to know. In this day and age, it's hard for him to text. It's a difficult process for him to now press the number 7 key over and over again to get the one letter that he needs to pop up next with the flashing black box on his flip phone. So I just think this guy was all about football, all about getting better, all about doing it the right way. Had a bunch of Colt games last year, and he's a star. There's no getting around it. They have a really nice supporting cast, but Luck was the real deal.
Absolutely, and as I've seen analyst Greg Cosell make reference to, they actually asked him to go downfield a disproportionate amount for a rookie, which shows you how much they trusted him right there. And at least he's not carrying around a brick phone like some of the hipsters out there. And when we say hipsters, I can't help but think of Brooklyn. And I do want to ask you about the Nets in a little bit here. But as far as it goes with covering the NFL, I know you've got the Jets preseason games as well. So your sense thus far heading into this bunch of preseason games this year, I mean, it looks like the circus has left town by and large from what we're hearing thus far, but your sense of how much more businesslike it is or it isn't in this, what might be the final year of Rex there?
Yeah, I think it is more businesslike. The sideshow is certainly not a factor like it once was. Tim Tebow last year was the dominant part of the conversation. And the reality is, since Mark Sanchez got there, they haven't had a quarterback to truly compete with him for the job. There was never a sense that he could lose his job. And that was a big problem. And not to say that Mark Sanchez wasn't motivated. He was. Mark wants to be good. Mark cares about being good. I think the issue is when he did hit a downward spiral, there were no other options. This coaching staff never believed that Tim Tebow could be the answer. They did not want to change their entire offense. They did not want it to be a gimmick. I'm still not sure why they acquired him, unless ownership just felt it was so important to sell jerseys, to create a buzz, to try to match the Giants coming off a Super Bowl title. That's the only reason I can come up with. Football-wise, it made no sense whatsoever. And it set the program back. It really did. Because when it started to go downhill, they had no answers last year. And there was a time where it was still in a state where it could have been repaired. And they just never got there. So this year, you look at their personnel, it's going to be a big challenge. There are a lot of teams in the NFL that are stacked, absolutely stacked. The Jets are not one of them. Personnel-wise, no. They're just not close. And look, coaching can do wonders in this league. We know that. Impressive schemes, impressive game plans. They can win you games at this level. I don't think in this day and age, when the disparity is as wide as it is, that they can be a shocker and somehow go out and win 10 games. I just, looking at their personnel, I just don't see it. I don't see how that's possible. If everything breaks right, if they win some games they're not supposed to win, they happen to be a team with a lot of heart that finds a way late in games, their defense makes plays, creates opportunities, they get some breaks on special teams. If everything breaks right, I don't know if they could ever be anything more than an 8-8 team right now. I mean, that to me is a best-case scenario, Rick, and that's very different than the expectations that they've had and the large plans that Rex Ryan and Mike Tannenbaum had in previous years.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds right on the money, no question about it, when you look at what's left there. And the fact that their first-round pick was a pick for the future as opposed to immediate impact, you bring Geno Smith in here. And I'm reminded of a conversation I had on the show a couple of years ago when I was querying somebody about why Giants fans had such skepticism about the drafting of JPP. I said, after all, he dominated Rutgers, and I was told in no uncertain terms, New York is not a college football town. That didn't register with anybody. Well, Geno Smith's most recent college game, a not very impressive outing at Yankee Stadium there in the Pinstripe
yep.
Bowl, and yet that doesn't appear to be impacting his honeymoon at all.
No, I think because what happens with the draft, there's a sense of optimism when you're trying to cling on to something. Geno Smith does have tape that pops off the screen. There are moments, and the arm is real. That is legit. The part of the equation that you just don't know yet, when he faced some adversity last year, he was mentioned as a Heisman hopeful early in the season. He was in that mix. And deservedly so. The numbers were legit. Well, when it started to really bottom out on him, he couldn't recover. And the part with the NFL is, we know, especially at that position, every week is an adventure. You're going against defensive coordinators who come up with game plans specifically to go against your abilities and your weaknesses, mind you, taking advantage of that. So the game now is obviously physical, but so much of it is mental. And that's just the part you don't know. You don't know how a guy's going to respond. Mark Sanchez has all the physical tools. The issues with Mark have been really from the neck up, decision-making, handling situations, and doing the right thing in the right moment, throwing the ball away when necessary, not forcing the ball over the middle, not trying to make a play when you know that your defense has kept you in the game. I don't know with Geno Smith how he's going to handle all that. Nobody knows that. You know, that's part of the mystery of the NFL, but I think one of the reasons why he has gotten a bit of a free pass so far from Jet fans is they want hope. They want something to latch on to right now, and yeah, Geno Smith is the closest thing they have to something that could develop over the next couple of years on this roster offensively.
Well, that's a very human reaction on their part, no doubt about it. And when you talk about mental preparation, what comes to my mind here is, you're getting ready, obviously, for the NFL season, but you've got to have some even stronger thoughts looking ahead this time of year, perhaps, than usual. This month of July has visited upon us some real news with your Brooklyn Nets there, a team that, again, made the playoffs last year. It didn't look to be a team that was necessarily going to go that far once they did, and they didn't go that far. But with the moves of adding Pierce and Garnett and some of the other fellows to the mix here, Jason Kidd as head coach, a real win-now imperative. So what are your initial reactions to the developments that have been going on there?
Well, Rick, the one thing that has stood out since Mikhail Prokhorov bought the team is they're willing to swing for the fences, and they don't always connect. We know that. They wanted LeBron James. They got on that list of teams he would meet with, but ultimately there was no deal to be made. He was focused on becoming a member of the Miami Heat, and it's worked out for him. Two championships. They got involved with Carmelo Anthony discussions with the Denver Nuggets. Didn't happen. Carmelo basically said, that's not where I see myself. The New York Knicks finally swooped in and gave up a lot to get Carmelo Anthony. Anthony Starr absolutely has benefited from the move to New York. A little more attention, although the playoff success hasn't been there. Carmelo has now been mentioned as one of the elite players in the NBA, and I think a lot of that is attributed to the fact that he is in the New York area. Fair, not fair, that's just the reality of the situation. Phil Jackson, a name that came up when the coaching situation was up in the air, made a call. Phil responded by saying not something that he would be interested in, maybe a front office job. Nets were not interested in that. They swing for the fences there for three entities that would have changed the way that they were perceived. After not getting Carmelo, they get Deron Williams in a deal. They surprised the rest of the NBA. Nobody even knew Deron Williams was on the block. And they make a deal with the Utah Jazz. They end up giving up some talent, but ultimately it's a deal that has not benefited Utah. If anything, it's benefited Brooklyn, as Deron was part of a playoff team last year. Utah still searching for an identity. Then they surprise everybody by hiring Jason Kidd. Has not coached a day in his life, but meant a lot to this franchise. They believe he can make the transition with the right mix of players. This was a cerebral star, someone who was able to elevate his game in big moments, win a championship with the Dallas Mavericks, and a player, obviously, that's synonymous with success with the Nets franchise. After that, they make a blockbuster. When Billy King sensed that the Boston Celtics were in trade mode and dump mode, they got involved. They gave up a lot in terms of future first-round picks, but they're looking at it as a two-year window where they feel they can compete for a championship. They swung for the fences, and they connected. It's very different the way that the team is now being seen around the league. For many, many years, Rick, you know this, they were known as Nowheresville in the NBA. The only way you would go to the Nets is if you got traded to the Nets because you were in a situation that a team wanted to get rid of you, or they were offering you more money than anybody else to sign as a free agent. That's it. There was no way you went there for any other reason. The franchise was not known as a great franchise, although Jason Kidd had gotten them to a point where they were credible. Over time and in the sale prior to Prokhorov, it didn't last, and that wore off. Now they're viable. They're a destination. That's hard to do. That's hard to do in a short period of time. They've been able to do that, and I give Billy King a lot of credit for doing it. Last year, a playoff team. This year now, a team that might be able to make some headway and going out and actually competing for a title.
Along those lines, in terms of the advances that they've made, Ian, it's very early to try to make sense of what might happen with this, but let's just go there anyways. The news coming recently that Madison Square Garden is going to have to vacate in 10 years. When you look at the perception of the Nets versus the Knicks over the years, that's been one of the big edges that the Knicks have had, the history of OMG, Madison Square Garden, 50-plus years in this location, and granted, it'll still be called Madison Square Garden. It'll still, in all likelihood, end up somewhere in Manhattan. But does the fact that that's going to be a new arena, minus any of the ghosts and the history and all the things that people revere about that place, is that yet another thing that maybe narrows the gap in terms of perception with the Nets?
Yeah, it could. It's obviously down the road, but I think that is something that the Nets feel could be a difference maker in 10 years from now if the Knicks are not playing at the hollowed floor of Madison Square Garden. That's a big part of their appeal. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see how all of that shakes out. They've just pumped a lot of money into refurbishing the Garden, making changes. And let me tell you, it's still a great place to do a game. There's an energy there. There's an electricity. There's a mystique when you walk inside that building. But with all of that said, I didn't know how Brooklyn would respond to having an NBA team. My first thought when all of this was announced was, well, how do you create an interest and a fan base out of thin air? And I was beyond surprised at what transpired last year. The arena was done in a classy manner. It's not over the top. Barclays Center, it's not an assault of your senses. They did it right, and it's a really nice venue for a game. To me, that's the other part of it. You could have all the bells and whistles. Do you enjoy watching a game there? Are the sight lines good? The lighting? All of that was covered. It was really well designed, and it's not one of these stadium-like arenas. Look, Chicago, great place, huge, immense, Staples Center, same deal. You look up, and there's just level upon level upon level. That's just not the case here. With the Barclays Center, the lower bowl is very close to the action, and upstairs it's much more intimate. It's a very different setting than what we've grown used to with the newer places being put up around the league. So I think they're ready to compete. They feel good about the team they have. They feel good about the venue they have. They feel good about what they've been able to project to the public. I don't know if it will ever just be a net town. I think that would be hard to do because of the Knicks' history, and you have generations and generations of Knicks fans. But the fact that they could make any kind of dent is a huge upset.
It really is. And as you said, it's a tremendous credit to ownership, the front office, the strides that they've made in the last couple of years. You alluded to different places, of course, that you've called games, and, of course, that would extend to the college games on CBS. I know you've called some games with Turner Sports as well, some NBA games on there. So do you have a greater sense of anticipation for this season than perhaps you might otherwise at this point in time? We're looking at a college crop next year that's going to yield probably the greatest NBA draft class in 11 years. This is the last year that a lot of the mega free agents are going to be under contract before they can opt out. So there's a lot of change that appears to be swirling in the wind here. And how do you look at this as an announcer heading into a season like this on both the college and the pro levels?
Yeah, it's a great question, Rick, because what we've learned is it's cyclical. There are great players that come around, and you question after a Michael Jordan retires. You say to yourself, well, that's it. I mean, we're not going to see anybody at that level again. And the reality is there's always somebody else. Not to say that they are Michael Jordan and can match him championship for championship, but what LeBron James has been able to bring to the league and Kobe Bryant, they're always going to be superstars. They just don't come around every year. And that's part of the intrigue in the NBA. Look, teams will tell you, hey, we're not throwing games, we're not tanking the season. I don't know. To me, you still got to go out and compete. There's not a player in the NBA that goes into a game thinking, well, I'm not going to play well tonight because maybe there's a chance my team can get the number one pick. It's not part of their mindset. It's not part of their constitution. Now, you just may not have a good enough team to compete night in and night out. I watched a 12-70 team with the then New Jersey Nets a few years ago. It wasn't from a lack of effort. It just didn't have the pieces in place. So they go 12-70, one of the worst seasons in NBA history, Rick, and they still don't get the number one pick. That year it's John Wall. Number two pick is Evan Turner. They end up taking Derek Favors with the third pick. He's part of the deal to acquire Deron Williams. So the only thing I would say to NBA teams that may be thinking, hey, this draft class is so good, let me just tank this year and see if we can get an all-timer. Rick Pitino thought the same thing when he took over the Boston Celtics. They had the highest percentage to get the number one pick. The Spurs got it. They got Tim Duncan. It changed their franchise. Rick Pitino ended up going to college and won another championship with Louisville last year. You can't write the script before it happens. With all of the talent that you alluded to, there's a lot to go around. And this might be a once-in-a-lifetime kind of draft class, but you still got to play out the string. You still have to go out there and try to make the best moves possible for your franchise because nothing is etched in stone.
Oh, that's absolutely the case, no question about that. Even the case with my beloved Cleveland Cavs, as bad as we sucked the first year after LeBron left, people tend to forget that was the Clippers pick that we used to get the number one pick to get Kyrie Irving. So, yeah, it's a low-percentage move to try to tank outright, and you're right, and most people do not really give credence to that. One more thing I'd like to ask you here. I'm noticing a similarity in something that you've done with another one of our guests, actually a four-time lounge guest, Kenny Albert, who got a chance to call the international version of the Super Bowl. I'm seeing, if Wikipedia is to be believed, and that hasn't always been the case with past guests here, but I'm seeing that you actually got to make the international call for the NBA Finals, you and your partner Jim Spanarkle calling the games for coverage overseas. What was that like? That must have really been a thrill.
Yeah, it was fun. I did the entire broadcast in Mandarin, which I don't know if most people realize that I'm fluent in, but no. I've had a chance to do it a number of times through the years. My first ever television broadcast on the NBA was the international broadcast of the finals, 1995, Houston and Orlando. And I had just done the Nets on radio and got an opportunity to do that, which was a huge, huge assignment for me at that time of my career. And I ended up calling a couple of those Bulls championships over Seattle, over Utah as well. So when the opportunity has popped up through the years, I've jumped on it. A lot of fun. This was a series to remember, an all-timer. That Game 6 was just an absolute thrill to call, and Game 7 came right down to the final minutes and seconds. So, you know, on a personal level, you want to call big games. You want to be associated. You want to be in those moments. And I'll never forget those games. That's something that will always stand out. For me, it's a personal highlight. You call the entire year in the NBA, and the way that it works, the TV guys locally do not get a chance to go and do playoff games after the first round, unless you're fortunate enough to work for Turner or for ESPN. And I'm really lucky that I do get opportunities to do that. But if the Nets make the finals this year, I don't get to call the games. That's part of being the local TV guy, and that's the trade-off. If I do get a chance to call them internationally, then at least you feel like you're part of it, and you feel like there's closure on the season.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, you might have to go international. In fact, you would, yeah, if you were going to call them in the finals. That's a very, very good point. Yeah,
I'll do radio for Korea if need be. If that's available, I'm okay with it. Well, maybe not. Maybe not Korea.
Do a couple possessions in rotating languages. That would really be great. You could do some showing off. This one's going to be in Swahili. The next one's going to be in Portuguese.
I minored in Swahili, so I'm not even sure how you knew that. That's amazing.
It's right in your wheelhouse, and then you can definitely handle that. But we always like to make sure that we plug things with our guests officially here, Ian. So any major projects that we've missed out on thus far, haven't covered sufficiently?
You know, tennis, I'll have the U.S. Open coming up. I'm working that for CBS and for Tennis Channel. Look forward to that. I think I have 9 or 10 days out there between the two networks. And that's always a lot of fun for me. I grew up about 10 minutes from Flushing Meadows and Forest Hills, the former home of the U.S. Open. So I was a tennis guy growing up. And on a personal level, that's always a highlight for the year. And then, you know, I'm a big movie guy, too. Through the years, I've tried to include pop culture in my broadcast, if applicable, without forcing it. And I was involved in a project on CBS back over the summer in June called Stars on Sports. We interviewed some entertainers about sports being the main focus, LL Cool J, Ethan Hawke, Ed Burns. We've got another edition of that coming up in September. Check your local listings for that. Denzel Washington, Mark Wahlberg, Ron Howard will be featured on that one. So it's a little bit of a departure, but a lot of fun for me. I still love just the whole concept of interviewing, the curiosity. It doesn't matter if it's sports, if it's entertainment. For me, that's still always interesting to sit down with someone that has a point of view. And I look forward to that, and maybe we'll do a few more of those as the months go by.
Excellent. And again, always enjoy checking out your work. And like I was joking about at the outset, as difficult as it might be to broadcast games of a team like the Browns have been over the years, I will say I always appreciate with you. I don't want to bag on any of your colleagues, but I'll just throw out the example of your one-time colleague, Gus Johnson. You know, I might wander into the kitchen, hear something in the other room, think I missed a touchdown, and it turns out it's a five-yard runoff tackle. So I appreciate that you give a good, steady call of the game, always reflective of what's going on the field, and that is truly appreciated, Ian.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm a big Gus guy, and he's been a friend for a long time. I understand, and look, he's a very popular figure, so obviously he's done something right, and it's working for him over in the soccer realm with Fox and all the other stuff that he's doing with college football. You know, on a personal level, as you know, broadcast style, you got to go with your gut. You got to go with your instincts, and for me, I don't take any of these games for granted, truly, and I mean that from as honest and real a place as possible. I know how fortunate I am to be calling these games. My preparation for any game that I'm assigned would be the same as if it was the Super Bowl or the AFC Championship. I would never insult the audience. I know how many people care about this, how many people build their weeks around watching these games. So I take the job very seriously and the preparation that comes along with it.
Well, the preparation shines through. We can all see it and really enjoy it. And, again, really enjoyed the conversation here today, Ian. We're really looking forward to it. Love to have you back on again sometime, sir. Thank you so much.
Rick, you got it. I don't know if I can match Kenny and his four appearances on the show, but I'd like to get to at least two. I'd feel good about taking that next step with number two at some point.
You can book it. We will make that happen at your convenience. And I know you're going to be busier once football and hoops are going on here, but hope to make it happen in between all of that. Thank you so much.
You got it, Rick. We'll talk down the road. Good luck this season, bud.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Good luck this year. And thank you for all for joining us here today. FDH Lounge mini episode number 288.